human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In mid-August last year, the Taliban took control of Afghanistan and the Western-backed government collapsed. On its anniversary, the Afghan people have not forgotten what they went through during this period. Economic collapse, triggered by the U.S. seizure of nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets and cuts in global aid, has been one of their main struggles. Afghans lived through a harsh winter with little food. Based on a poll by Gallup Institute, nearly all Afghans rated their lives as poorly enough to be considered suffering. Meanwhile, some neighboring countries and international bodies rushed aid to the country.
We witnessed that after the Taliban takeover, people sold their children and body organs to put food on the table. I personally lost my job and have been unemployed for months. Millions of others were unable to make ends meet due to food and cash scarcity. I urge the U.S. and the international community to release frozen Afghan funds and let the flow of aid. Afghans can no longer bear the ongoing miseries.
The security situation in the meantime has been far better than in the past two decades. That's to say, people experienced less violence and conflict this year. However, the occasional attacks by the Daesh terrorist group continue to haunt the community.
Previously, our people were living with the U.S. bombardments on their territories. Under the pretext of the war against terror, the U.S. pushed terror in Afghanistan for 20 years and violated all rights of Afghans. Since the Taliban have come to power, our country has been more secure and peaceful. I hope the Taliban succeed in cracking down on Daesh terrorist group and tightening security for all.
The Taliban, on the other hand, failed to gain international recognition. Afghans and the global community have criticized the Taliban for not forming an all-inclusive government.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover. To date, the Taliban have been unable to form a government representing all walks of Afghan society and protect their rights. In Afghanistan's history, no government has been successful without securing national legitimacy and being inclusive. The Taliban should learn from the past, seek fair engagement with Afghans, and be flexible against the global community.
All things considered, international bodies and rights groups continue to engage with the de facto Taliban to advocate for the rights of Afghans and address their needs. They also have been calling on the Taliban to open girls' schools as soon as possible. 1 year into the Taliban government, Afghans are calling on the international community to help the country's economy and force the U.S. to release its frozen assets. At the same time, they say the new government should engage more in diplomacy with other countries to improve the situation in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
As Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza and Al-Quds persist, another war continues to rage on in Europe. The battle pits pro-Palestine activists pushing a global anti-Israel boycott campaign versus local authorities who back ties with Israel. Founded in 2005, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a Palestinian-led movement promoting economic sanctions on Israel. Due to the movement's popularity, Tel Aviv has lobbied European lawmakers to criminalize the group and its activities. France, Germany and Britain are key battlegrounds, but lesser known is the struggles of the BDS in Austria. Speaking to local members, a crackdown on BDS activism remains ongoing.
It started in 2018 when, the local city government of Vienna, they implemented city resolutions, for example, against the BDS movement, where they say all local institutions and governmental institutions are not allowed anymore to support the movement, so which means all public places, they are restricted for us. All these restrictions against the BDS movement in Austria, in Europe and worldwide, I think it's a reaction from the Zionist movement and from the Zionist lobby, because BDS is getting stronger and stronger.
The Vienna city government are currently suing a BDS Austria representative over a Facebook post showing an image plastered over an official city poster. Elsewhere, support for the BDS can get you labelled anti-Semitic, due to Austria adopting the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
European authorities are introducing new legislation which aims to stop the activities of the peaceful boycott campaign. But policing people's desires not to invest in the Israeli regime is proving a near impossible task. Speaking to representatives of the BDS here in Vienna, they say that the response is an inevitable backlash to the group's success in undermining and damaging Israel's reputation across the continent. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says he had a side talk with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad on the sidelines of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in October last year. The Turkish minister added he suggested a reconciliation to take place between the Syrian government and the opposition, noting that without such a step, Syria will continue to face a crisis. Cavusoglu said that the EU and the international community would support a ceasefire in the war-torn country, and that no country would help in Syria's rebuild the process if a ceasefire is not achieved.
To prevent the division of Syria, there must be a strong administration in Syria. The will that can dominate every corner of its lands can only be achieved through unity and solidarity. We need to bring the opposition and government together for reconciliation. There will be no permanent peace otherwise.
Some believe such a revelation is a signal indicating Turkey is preparing for its cross-border military operation in northern Syria. In recent weeks, the Turkish army has been sending reinforcements to northern Syria, near the town of Tel Rifat. The town is under the control of Kurdish YPG forces, a U.S.-backed militia that Turkey considers the armed wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK.
I think the timing of this announcement comes as Turkey's preparing for a cross-border military operation to secure the border area and push back Kurdish forces. A reconciliation between the government and the opposition will not only bring peace to Syria, but also Turkey, a country that has been directly affected by the Syrian war from terrorist attacks to the refugee crisis.
Some analysts believe Turkey has long been serving its own agenda in Syria. For example, by supporting some opposition groups inside Syria who served Ankara's interest in securing its borders and pushing Kurdish forces back. It might be soon to say whether Ankara has changed its strategy in regards with Syria. What is clear for Turkey is that fighting or defeating the Kurdish militants cannot guarantee its security. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Gas bills in Italy will likely double in cost from October the 1st if gas prices continue to rise this way. The recent announcement by power regulator ARERA has gone utterly unnoticed, with the Italian media focusing on the electoral campaign about a month away from the September 25 national elections. A week ago, the outgoing Italian government unveiled a 17 billion euros aid package aimed at protecting families from surging energy costs and rising consumer prices. However, ARERA and some energy experts have warned that very little has been done so far to reduce energy consumption in the country.
Italy's highly critical energy situation has been downplayed by politicians and the media. On one side, there is confidence about the country achieving its target of reaching storage levels of 90%, while on the other side, the risk that Russia could altogether stop the flow of gas to Italy has been underplayed.
Gas is central to Italy's energy systems. The country even produces over 50% of its electricity from natural gas. Rome has cut its reliance on Russian gas imports to 25% from about 40% at the start of the year, a decision that has thrown the energy sector into uncertainty. Some analysts have predicted annual gas bills could reach an average of 1,800 euros next year, almost double the annual average of 950 euros recorded this year. Many Italians are simply bewildered about how they can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire. But Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
and a supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As Afghanistan marks a year since its occupiers left the country, in particular the U.S.,
country is facing many challenges. Not that it was free of them. Its economic system is in peril, yet the U.S. refuses to give back Afghanistan's government's money to the ruling government, the Taliban. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at U.S.'s disastrous Afghanistan occupation and pullout a year ago, and then see how the country can pull back from the brink. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magner joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Marseille, France. Also joining us will be Frank Emspach. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you both for joining us in this program. Elijah Magner, I'm going to first start with you. We're looking at Afghanistan's one-year anniversary, and let me see what they have called it, the Day of Salvation and Freedom. If they have called it that, natural question, one of them would be, have they been salvaged and freed?
Thank you for having me. At least they were freed from the U.S. occupation that remained in the country for 20 years and occupied the country to liberate Afghanistan from the Taliban and, according to the Doha Agreement carried out by Donald Trump and later on by Joe Biden, gave back the power to the Afghan Taliban again, once again, after 20 years. So what the Americans did is exactly what Julian Assange said, that the Americans were aiming for a long war, not a successful war. What the Americans have done after 20 years of occupation of the country, they basically destroyed the country and left the country with the suspension of the international aid, freezing of access to Afghanistan foreign exchange reserves, and blocking $9 billion that Joe Biden is withholding on the Afghan population in exchange of course, dictating its own conditions, of which starting with appointing a central bank director that's selected by the Americans. So because of the dire situation in Afghanistan, because of the Americans have destroyed the country and left the country really on the floor, the Afghani today can't really maintain the country and can't survive without foreign aid. Now, there is no foreign aid. It's very little arriving to Afghanistan, nothing to compare of what the Americans and the Europeans are giving to the Ukrainian in their war against Russia. So without an international support, with the security challenges, with the Americans sending drones and assassinating whoever they want, violating the Afghanistan's sovereignty, the situation in Afghanistan 1 year after the withdrawal of the U.S. occupation force is not looking very well.
Well, on this day, Frank Emspach, you have many Afghans that are of the belief that good riddance. They said death to the United States. This day is the day of the victory of truth over falsehood and the day of salvation and freedom of the Afghan nation. Many of them came out and relayed that sentiment. What brings a question that comes about here is, what was the U.S. doing in Afghanistan which saw them required them to stay in that country for 20 years and then pull out when they did?
Well, I think that part of the reason we went into Afghanistan is that we wanted to wreak revenge on the 9/11 destruction, and Afghanistan was a handy target. We weren't going to attack the people who attacked us, Saudi Arabia. All the people who were doing this were Saudis. And they were holed up in what used to be an American base in Afghanistan. So it was a clear target, and it was a chance for the United States to, what we thought, overthrow a weak government and take over. Well, it didn't work out that way. And once you get involved in this kind of thing, a country like ours, or France for that matter, in Africa, and or in Indochina a generation ago, it's hard for the leadership to admit it and say, well, you know, this was not a good idea. And we'll let the Afghanistanis run their own country. So once you're involved, you have this escalating situation, at least here, who lost Afghanistan, and a fear of the government from being attacked by people who claim it's weak. I think, though, that at this stage of the game, the destruction of the country is what's first and foremost. And I think what we saw here today in this country, that is Saturday, Sunday, and today is Monday, there was extensive coverage of Afghanistan for the first time in almost a year. And what was interesting about it is that some of the coverage actually mentioned that the Taliban were trying to accomplish something, not all favorable, but mentioning that some schools had been reopening. And an interesting thing in the New York Times coverage was the focus on women in medical school there, and that that's still functioning. And so it was, for the first time, not a completely negative series of articles. Now, I was only looking at the Times, the Wall Street Journal, and National Public Radio, so I can't say what happened throughout the rest of the media. Mm-hmm. But at least some recognition that there was something going on there other than just repression. However, there was no real focus on one of the facts that the United States has basically stolen the Afghan treasury and has made things much, much more difficult. There did not seem to be an emphasis, however, on anything like the United States getting ready to try to overthrow the current government, which I thought was a good thing that that was not focused, not a focus of the news.
Well, Elijah Magner, I'm trying to put things into perspective over here when it comes to the one-year anniversary and how the Taliban has, well, I was going to say progressed, but actually hasn't progressed much. So you're looking at a list of factors over here where they have not been recognized by the international community. You're looking at the fact that, for example, the marginalization of minorities, marginalization of women, a ban on secondary education for girls on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have people dying from hunger. There's no work. Unemployment is skyrocketing. And it almost looks as if, not that I'm saying the woman recognition is not very important, or having what the U.S. considers a terrorist to be, I think, the central bank, holding a position in the central bank, as you mentioned. But if you put things into perspective, the country is not doing well. Shouldn't there be more focus on the humanitarian and the economic side of things, as opposed to, well, because they're not letting women come into the workforce and or things that have to do perhaps with the way that women are not given opportunities?
Well, here in the West, the focus mainly on something more exciting, talking only about women's rights and the women going to school or allowed to go to school and university, disregarding the fact that Afghanistan is really starved. According to the looking at Afghanistan from a real perspective, one should look at what are the priorities first. The priorities is not, of course, to undermine minority and to mistreat women and prevent the schooling and university, etc., but first to allow people to survive and eat and be able to stand on their feet and grow in a country that has been devastating by occupation and was not doing well even before the occupation. So what we see today, one thing positive is the drop of civilian casualties since August 2021 that went from 7,000 to 1,000. However, we see increased action of the Islamic State Khorasan that the Americans have contributed not to fight, but to transport from Syria to Afghanistan. So all these disregarding the
why would they do that?
Security. Sorry?
Why would they do that? Why would they transfer the Daesh terrorists from, I think you said, Syria to Afghanistan?
Well, because they were facing Taliban and not managing to face Taliban. So they wanted the enemy of Taliban because ISIS was in Syria the enemy of everybody, including the extremist Sunnis and Al-Qaeda. And because Al-Qaeda and Taliban are together, so ISIS Khorasan were transferred from northeast Syria into Afghanistan to fight the Taliban. And because the Americans had no real intention to withdraw and they did not have a clear idea when to leave, and we saw how Donald Trump spent several years in negotiating in Doha, and when Joe Biden came, he did not want to leave, and he was mainly forced to leave because he was not expecting Taliban to take Kabul so quickly and wanted the Afghan army to fight for at least 6 months. So this didn't happen. The Americans were taken by surprise. They were forced to abandon the embassy, abandon the city, were caught at the airport, and they had to flee the country. So all that speeded up the delivery of power to Taliban by the same Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, at that time, because he saw how the Americans abandoned him. So now the country is really under financial difficulties, and the Americans are the main factor contributing by freezing $9 billion to a poor country devastated by a war and blocking all this very vital asset to the Afghanis. This is a main contributor, and that is the priority of the Afghani government today, is to feed the population and to look after what's going to happen to the infrastructure. They can't do that.
Well, I mean, you know, Frank Emspach, when you take a look at the Afghans and they're seeing this $9 billion in frozen funds not being returned, you can imagine how they feel about the U.S. after this. Even the ones who perhaps had an admiration for the U.S., I'm sure that has been dented. You're looking at the $9 billion, you're looking at the halting of foreign aid that at some point constituted 80% of Afghanistan's annual budget, if you can believe that. And you said, Frank Emspach, that you thought at one point that maybe the U.S. Was contemplating coming back into Afghanistan. Well, I mean, aren't these actions by the U.S. somewhat a recipe for a country to be choked off to the point where maybe the U.S. does have the intention of perhaps coming back into the country, or at a minimum, making sure that country remains unstable?
I think the minimum making it keep unstable is an objective of some, but not all. I think we have to go back to that 80% business. No country can go with 80% of its budget being paid for by a third party from on August 1st to zero on August 18th and expect that everything's going to be okay. And I think that that's what we did. In addition to that, although, yes, we have allowed some foreign aid, the fact of the matter is all kinds of sanctions are in place. We've made it extremely difficult for other aid agencies and other countries to give money to Afghanistan. The exception seems to be the International Red Cross, who is running about 30 hospitals in Afghanistan at the moment. But the fact of the matter is, if we as Americans or all the people in Western Europe, what we used to call Western Europe, want to deal with this honestly, we have to demand that our governments pay up, you know, support the Afghan government, not decide we're going to let people starve to death because we don't like the Taliban, and recognize that within the Taliban, as was on National Public Radio yesterday, here, you had two leading Taliban people debating each other about, you know, how important the education of women was, high schools, and pointing out that in about a third of the country, the high schools for women are open because the people will not stand for them being closed. And so the NPR correspondent said, gee, you mean that there's all that kind of opposition? And one of the leaders said, it isn't opposition. We have a difference of opinion on that. That's perfectly valid. And a third of the country, he said, we have women in high school. He said, so, yes, we have internal divisions. Now, that, I think, when you can discuss that kind of thing openly on international news, these guys were both leaders in Afghanistan. This is a pretty good thing, it seems to me, and would suggest that if we, the United States, would get our foot off their neck and not continue to assassinate people in the middle of their capital and whatnot, right, and allow politics to grow, we're going to have a much more secular and a much more democratic system than we had there under American rule.
Right.
That should be our objective. And the only way that's going to happen, I think, is if American people or the French people say that our governments have to actually be serious in building the country and not making it difficult for the government.
I mean, you know, we could talk about just the $9 billion and form a program out of that. Because if we really think about it, if the U.S. is so concerned about where this money is going to go, why don't they start with $1 billion and see how that's going to go? Forget $1 billion, $500 million. No, seriously, looking at a country that people are dying in there after all this time. And I mean, that country is not doing well. Iran is doing its share of having the refugees come in, you know. But let's move on to the whole Daesh al-Qaeda situation, Elijah Magnier. And I'm not trying to imply anything. I'm really curious as to how that stands. Why, if you think the Taliban could do more to eliminate them, especially coming on the heels of Ayman al-Zawahiri to have been killed by the U.S. forces, which they said they don't need a DNA to have that proven. But regardless, is the Taliban actually doing enough to eradicate it, Daesh, from the country?
Al-Qaeda is not the enemy of Taliban and vice versa. So the Taliban never had the intention to eliminate Al-Qaeda. On the contrary, they offer shelter to Al-Qaeda, but they didn't want Al-Qaeda to carry out operation or terrorist attacks against other countries, starting from Afghanistan. That was the main problem between the Taliban and the Americans, because the Taliban refused to deliver Al-Qaeda leaders to the Americans. Now, when Ayman al-Zawahiri is killed in the middle of Kabul, he was offered a shelter willingly by the Taliban government, and the Americans were not very much foreign to what Al-Qaeda is doing there and to the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And also, I would like to add something else. The Americans negotiated with the Taliban for over 3 to 4 years in the Doha, in Qatar. So they were very much aware that the Taliban were taking the leadership of the country and they will be the next ruler. So if they like it or not, if they didn't want the Taliban, they would not have negotiated with them. When Joe Biden said, I expected the army to last for at least 6 months, because he knew at the end of these 6 months, had the army held its position and fought the Taliban, will give up on the capital to the Taliban. So everybody was aware that the Taliban will take over. Taliban and Al-Qaeda are friends. The only problem is they both have one common enemy, is the ISIS, Khorasan, or the Islamic State. They don't have, they are not the enemy of the Americans. They said it today, Zabihullah Mujahid said today, we want good relationship with the Americans, and we expected the Americans to stand by their deal and the Doha agreement, which they not. So it is not a question of relationship between Al-Qaeda and Taliban. The Americans collaborated widely with Al-Qaeda in Syria. They supported them. They trained many of Al-Qaeda members under the name of jihadis that we know they are under the Al-Qaeda umbrella. So it has never been a real issue. It is just selective when the Americans want to assassinate an Al-Qaeda leader. Well, they go for that just for domestic reasons and domestic policy.
I was making perhaps a mistake of grouping all of them as Daesh terrorists. And perhaps thank you for breaking that open or breaking that up and explaining the difference there. Amir Khan Muttaqi is the acting foreign minister, Frank M. Spack. One of the statements he made on this day is, quote, we want a good relationship with all countries. And then my question to you of what he said, we won't let Afghanistan's territory be used against anyone. Who's going to be using the Afghan territory against another country? And which country or countries is he referring to, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert on all the different organizations that are attacking Pakistan or involved in various activities against Iran or whatever. But I think that the major point that the Afghan government is trying to make here is that they will not tolerate the use of Afghanistani territory as a launching pad for anybody against anybody. And I think that's what they're trying to accomplish, and that they may have other political organizations that are taking shelter there. That's one thing as far as they're concerned. But using Afghanistan as a launching pad is another. They're trying to exert a sovereignty and say that the Afghanis are equal, and people should recognize them as such. And I believe that you're going to see that begin to happen relatively soon. It may not happen with the United States, but we take a look at what we did in Vietnam. It was the same story. All of a sudden, we said, oh, my God, what's happening here? And the Saigon army collapsed in, 2 months? you know, from about January to April, finished, right? And we've been saying all along in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then instead of following through on the peace plan that we had, you know, there were supposed to be reparations, remember that? It was supposed to be trade and all that. Forget it for 10 years, you know?
Right.
And so we also did the same thing there as we're doing with Afghanistan. And I think it's really unseemly and hypocritical and the wrong thing for this country to be doing. So we, the United States, can make a major contribution to stability there, should we wish to do so. But it doesn't, that's the case.
Well, unless you're making instability 60 kilometers close to where China's. Final question comes to you, Elijah Magnier. Please explain to us in a short time, 1 minute, if you can, what's going on with the neighbors of Afghanistan, in particular China, Iran, and Pakistan. China is said to, another question is how China actually received the Taliban, it seems like from the get-go, when they took over. It is now said that they are not incurring tariffs on any of the imports that come, anything that goes into the country, and they've actually are somewhat cooperating security with Afghanistan. But regionally, with the regional countries and neighbors, how do you see things going from this point on?
From the first day the Americans completed their withdrawal from Afghanistan, from Kabul, immediately Iran supplied Afghanistan with oil most needed in the country. China rushed to Afghanistan and offered its support because stability in Afghanistan is extremely important, not only for Pakistan, but also for China, even if the borders are not very large, but with Iran as well. And we see many delegations going to Tehran because the security in Afghanistan, stability in Afghanistan is extremely important to maintain the security on the borders and make sure there will not be a flood of Afghani refugees in Iran, as it's actually happening today and in the last year because of the economic situation. So the stability in Afghanistan is very important for the neighboring country and not seemingly important for the Americans who were there for 20 years and were very much aware what kind okay. of security Afghanistan is in need of.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're fresh out of time, but thank you so much. Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor, University of Wisconsin for Madison. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, Journalist and Political Analyst from Marseille, France. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini authored the book Kashf al-Asrar in response to the misleading book 1000 Year Secrets, which had been written by Ali Akbar Hakamizadeh, an erstwhile student of seminary who left for the U.S. while no more wearing the costume of clergymen. It was said that Imam Khomeini's book can be considered as the starting point of his struggles against the Pahlavi regime and his endeavor to establish the Islamic rule. Today, we are going to dwell upon that part of the Imam's struggles which were against the Shah's so-called White Revolution. As usual, the narrator is mainly Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Borujerdi in 1961, Iran's Shah, Mohammad Reza, thought that one of the main obstacles against his anti-religious moves and consolidation of his tyrannical rule had gone. Therefore, he started fighting off Islam and ulema very seriously and openly. However, his dream was very soon shattered by Imam Khomeini's uprising, which fell upon him like a nightmare. The Imam raised the banner of a struggle against the regime and its main supporter, the U.S., opening a new chapter in the political and religious atmosphere of the country. Imam Khomeini's wife narrates, "The Imam was a wise, clever, and religious man. After the demise of Ayatollah Borujerdi, he staged uprising against the Shah apparatus, which wanted to set aside religion and march in the path of the West. As he was a very religious and devoted person, whenever the religion and religiosity were mocked at, it was as if his children had been beheaded in front of him. After the late Borujerdi, the Shah intended to set aside clergymen and religion in Iran forever. Of course, he had made the decision at the time of late Borujerdi, but his power wouldn't let the Shah do such a thing. In those days, the man of politics and the field of a struggle against the regime was Ayatollah Kashani, and Mr. Khomeini was acquainted with him, but there was not a political relation in the modern sense, and, as I have said, the Imam's main job was studying and discussion." Imam Khomeini had a positive opinion on the struggles of Ayatollah Kashani, although he had some critical views too. The Imam's wife continues, "My father said that when Mr. Kashani had seen Mr. Ruhullah for the first time, he told my father, 'Where have you found this prodigy? He's a good base for the future.' Mr. Khomeini liked Mr. Kashani's struggles generally and would go to his house too. But it was not that much to say that he had a role in late Kashani's political establishment. After late Borujerdi, the Imam, besides studying and discussion, had become a source of emulation himself and considered himself responsible before events. Thus, he couldn't be silent against deviations and believed that silence against oppression is a bigger oppression. In the winter of 1963, the American President John F. Kennedy advised the Shah to implement the so-called reforms, calling it the White Revolution, or the Revolution of the Shah and the People. This measure comprised issues which were seemingly useful, such as land reforms, granting the right to vote to women, and giving shares of the profits of factories to workers. But the Shah's main aim was to bolster the foundation of his despotic rule and destroying strong social forces, such as the clergymen and landowners. Ms. Sagafi says, in 1963, the government decided to do some reforms. Although it was not that important, it implied issues which would make them important. The imam believed that the Shah had taken the first step cautiously, but his next steps would be serious danger for Islam and the country's independence. Therefore, he couldn't be silent against the Shah anti-religious moves. Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Sagafi, referring to her protest to the imam as why he was the only one among the ulema and sources of emulation to oppose the Shah's plan, says, "The imam felt his duty in this regard and considered himself accountable before God. I told him, why do other ulema and sources of emulation not protest and it is only you who feel the duty?" He answered, "I don't bother them, lady. By God, I am responsible. If you are ready to see God punishing me on the judgment day, tell me to keep silent." So I was sure that the imam had a mission which he had to fulfill. Therefore, I always tried to pave the ground for his activity. Imam Khomeini's courageous and explicit opposition to the Shah's so-called referendum infuriated the latter, and there were rumors of arresting the imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini was so calm and unmoved. Ms. Sagafi narrates as follows. "The morning gatherings and narrations of Imam Hussein's tragedy were different from those of the previous years. Little by little, these narrations were finding their true meaning, which was the memory of martyrs and combatants of the path of freedom and religion. They had gradually changed from amusement and stupor to movement and awareness. Preachers had turned the issue from the state of stupor and would prepare the people for resistance against all tortures and torments. Preparation for uprising, the uprising like Hussein by his descendant Khomeini. When the rumor prevailed on Imam Khomeini's arrest, one night he told me, 'If they arrest me, do not be anxious.' I told him jokingly, 'That's good, as I will breathe for a while.' In the advent of his struggles, the imam would tell Ahmad, 'Tonight they may arrest me. Don't fear. If they come and arrest me, don't do anything. Don't seek help from anyone to relieve me. Even do not accept anyone's money for livelihood.'"
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.